in heaven, we thank you for your evident presence in our seminar all during this week, ever since last Sabbath. And we again believe tonight that you will honor your promise that where two or three are gathered together in your midst, that you will also be there. We invite the Holy Spirit to come and be the master, teacher, and leader of our seminar again this evening. And may he lead us and guide us into all of the truth of which we are capable of comprehension at our present stage of spiritual development. And we thank you in Jesus' name. Amen. Our theme this week is Why I Believe Ellen White to Be a True Prophet of the Lord. We started out, first of all, my first reason, because she fulfills Bible prophecy. My second reason, because she passes the four Bible tests of a true prophet and passes them admirably. Third, last night, because there is a supernatural element in her experience that cannot be denied. We pointed out last evening, you'll remember, that there are two supernatural powers in the world, and of course, Satan is a supernatural power. So whenever we see evidences of the supernatural, we have to validate it to try to find out who is the source of this supernatural experience. And tonight, my fourth reason why I believe is because many prominent non-Adventist members of our church have spoken so highly, so appreciatively of Ellen White that I am interested. This doesn't prove anything, but I am interested that that is so. 300 or 400 years before Jesus came, there was a Greek philosopher whose name was Aristotle, and he wrote a book with a one-word title. He called it Rhetoric, which is still used as a textbook in modern universities today. And in his book, he identified three major sources or causes of persuasive proof. The three major sources were logos, ethos, and pathos. What did he mean by those terms in Latin? Well, logos tells us that we are persuaded often at the intellectual level by factual evidence which has a strong appeal to our rational faculties. Ethos, another Latin term, ethos highlights the high moral character of the presenter, which also carries a certain compelling conviction. You see, we tend to believe the statements of men and women when we perceive them to be highly ethical. And in communication theory today, practitioners speak glibly of this phenomenon in terms of source credibility. And source credibility is a big thing in the world of communication today. The third of Aristotle's three proofs he called pathos, which represented emotional appeals, which also convince and motivate us to action as highly persuasive factors. And today, we hear a great deal about the value, the importance, the place of source credibility, for people still tend to believe and accept the veracity of the testimony of men and women who are perceived to possess extremely high ethos. But source credibility, as you will immediately recognize, also is a two-edged sword. You see, I might say, well, I tend to believe Ellen White was a prophet because her message has been endorsed and advocated by intelligent, informed, articulate persons of high moral probity. But someone else might come along and say equally, well, I tend to doubt that Mrs. White was a prophet because of some equally prominent persons who expressed doubt and disbelief concerning her ministry. Of course, source credibility is not the only or even the most important test or proof or reason to believe. And of course, source credibility can be manipulated and wrongly applied, as in the case of Jesus, by the ecclesiastical leaders of his time. You're familiar with those statements in John 7. There's two evidences of source credibility, that argument being used against Jesus in John 7. In verse 41, it was said scornfully, why he comes from Galilee. Why that fact alone proves that he can't be a somebody. Search and look, for out of Galilee ariseth no prophet. Can any good thing come out of Nazareth? But of course, they were wrong. Two of the Hebrew prophets of the Old Testament did come out of Galilee. I speak of both Nahum and Jonah. They were Galileans. But you know, when people are using these kinds of arguments, they don't worry about the facts. They are concerned about the effect of their words. And then in the very next verse, in verse 48, it was scornfully questioned, "Have any of the rulers or of the Pharisees believed on him?" The implication was, no, nobody, none of the big people have accepted Jesus. But again, they were wrong. The facts disproved their central thesis. For Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea, both of them wealthy beyond belief, Josephus tells us that both of those men had enough money in the Bank of Jerusalem to feed the entire population of Jerusalem for 10 years out of their bank account. Wealthy beyond belief. Both were members of the exclusive Sanhedrin governing body, and both were disciples of Jesus, although initially, secretly, for fear of the Jews, as John tells us in John 19:38. Jesus recognized the potential hazards of source credibility, and once ruefully observed that a prophet is not without honor and due recognition, except in his own hometown and in his own house. Now, my belief in Ellen White as an authentic, true prophet of the Lord does not rest alone or even chiefly upon the fact that a large number of highly prominent non-Seventh-day Adventists who obviously had no personal or denominational axe to grind, they had some glowing, highly appreciative things to say about this little lady. And the evidence that I'm going to share with you this evening is barely a tithe of that which could be presented, except for a limited amount of time. But after it's all said and done, the fact remains that a large number of non-Adventists have expressed profound appreciation and said some remarkable things about the life and the 70-year ministry and the teachings of Ellen White. And quite frankly, I admit to being impressed by the wide array of such persons who came from so many different diverse walks in life. You should be too. A significant number have spoken favorably concerning Mrs. White, and as I said, they had no axe to grind personally. They gained nothing personally from their endorsement. The first one I want to mention tonight is Dr. William Foxwell Albright. He was born in 1891. He died in 1971 at the age of 80. He was the 20th century's foremost authority on the life and the culture of the times of antiquity in the Middle East. If you talk about archaeology, if you talk about the culture of the Middle East, if you talk about the history of the Middle East, Dr. Albright was your premier authority. He was incredibly the author of more than 800 separate scientific articles. Some he co-authored, some he solely authored. And Dr. Albright got his doctorate at Johns Hopkins University when he was about 25 years of age. And later he taught there for a number of years. He was the recipient of 25 honorary doctoral degrees granted by Protestant, Jewish, and Roman Catholic universities, colleges, and seminaries. He was a man of incredible erudition. And in 1959, when he was then 68 years of age, I was taking my master's degree at our seminary, which was then located in a suburb of Washington, D.C. And we were told during a certain week that next Sunday morning, Dr. William Foxwell Albright was going to lecture in a Jewish synagogue on Connecticut Avenue in Washington, D.C., a very posh address. Congregation Addis Israel was the name of that synagogue. And so I said to a few of my friends, "I'm going to go down and hear him. Wouldn't you like to go?" And they said, "Yes." And I think we had five or six seminary students in my car. We drove down. And we heard him. The thing that astonished me right at the very start, even before he opened his mouth to speak, was the respect, the honor, even the adulation that was shown him by several dozen rabbis who had come from all over just to hear the man speak. They did not treat him as they would perhaps normally treat a goyim, a Hebrew word for a Gentile. They treated him with the utmost respect and regard, and they practically worshiped the ground that he walked on. Dr. Albright wrote a book which was entitled From the Stone Age to Christianity. In that book, which he wrote, published in the early 1950s, in that book he talked about the development of history and culture from the prehistoric Stone Age down to the Christian era. When the second edition of that book was published in 1957, Albright wrote a new introduction. And in the new introduction for the second edition, Albright said, I think in the last 200, 300 years, there have been perhaps five people that I would equate at the same level as the prophets of the Hebrew Old Testament. And one of the five people that he named was Ellen G. White. He considered her a prophet on the same level with the Old Testament prophets of the Bible. When I discovered this fact, I asked one of my seminary professors, who now sleeps in Jesus, Dr. Alger F. Johns, I said, how on earth did a man of his stature teaching, he taught 30-some years, I think 37 years, at Johns Hopkins University. How did a man of his stature ever hear about Ellen White? And Dr. Johns' face visibly brightened, and he looked at me with a big smile, and he said, because I told him about her. You see, Dr. Johns, and also another seminary professor who's still alive, Dr. Leona Running, I saw her just last June. We had a reunion of seminary former alumni of the seminary in Tacoma Park, and Dr. Running was there and made a public presentation, very lovely one. Both Dr. Johns and Dr. Running took their Ph.D. degrees at Johns Hopkins University with William Foxwell Albright as their major professor. And Dr. Johns told me, he said, I witnessed to him about Ellen White, and I sufficiently aroused his curiosity that he went and did research on his own about Ellen White, and came to the conclusion, which he stated in print, not embarrassed to state it in print, which he stated in print in the second edition, the introduction to the second edition, From the Stone Age to Christianity, that in the last 200-300 years, there have been five people who I consider to be on the same level as the Old Testament prophets, and Ellen White was one of those. There was a lady that I met in, About 1960-something. Her name was Edith Dean. She lived in Fort Worth, Texas, and she was one of the foremost writers on women. In fact, she kind of specialized in women's history. She amassed a library of more than 2,000 books dealing with women in secular and sacred history. And I met her in Fort Worth, Texas, a number of years ago, an internationally known author, lecturer, and pulpit, a public personality. For more than 25 years, she held the post of woman's editor and columnist in a Fort Worth, Texas daily newspaper. She was a frequent guest on radio and television programs, wrote widely on feminist issues and on women in history, and two different universities in Texas, the Texas Women's University and the Texas Christian University, 13 years apart, accorded her an honorary Doctor of Literature. I visited with her on June 2 of 1983 at her home. She was then 78 years of age. She died 10 years later. You know, I did a little more research today in your local library over here in Bettendorf, and it was not until today I was doing some research on Edith Dean, getting my notes updated, that I discovered that she had passed away in 1994, 6 years ago. After she had finished writing a landmark book, which was entitled All the Women of the Bible, Mrs. Dean followed up with a sequel, which she entitled The Great Women of the Christian Faith, published in 1959 by the prestigious publishing firm of Harper & Brothers. Her book on all the great women of the Christian faith contains inspiring biographies of 123 outstanding women who lived all through 19 different centuries of the Christian church. And she divided them into two categories. She prepared 76 concise sketches. That was her designation. Each one of these concise sketches was about a page in length. And she did that for 76 of the 123 women. But for 47 of the women, she wrote chapter-length full studies on women of greater renown. And Ellen White was one of those 47 women who got the full chapter treatment, not just a full-page concise sketch. And she titled her chapter on Ellen White, Ellen G. White, Pioneer and Guide of Her Church. And then she added a subtitle which epitomized how Mrs. Dean felt about her chief characteristic, her subtitle, She Kept Her Faith in Constant Exercise. By the way, if you should find this book in a secondhand bookstore or even in a contemporary bookstore, don't buy it unless you have ascertained that the chapter on Mrs. White is in the book. Because an evangelical Christian book club authorized a separate publication of this book, and unwittingly I bought a copy in a bookstore thinking I had the original book, and I discovered there was no chapter on Mrs. White. And I wrote to the publisher and I said, I understand that in the original copy of this book there was a chapter. Oh yes, they said, we deleted two chapters when we published it for our book club. The chapter on Mary Baker Eddy, the founder of Christian Scientism, and the chapter on Ellen White, one of the co-founders of the Seventh-day Adventist Church. It was an evangelical book club, and I understand fully why they deleted those two chapters. I have both books at home now. I've got the book club selection, and I've also got the original book by Harper and Brothers. On June 2 of 1983, I met with Mrs. Dean. I arranged in advance for an interview. I asked her if she could give me a half hour of her time, and she very graciously said that she could. I was in Texas for a camp meeting assignment. I was doing one or two series there during the week. And so one afternoon, I drove up from the camp meeting out there at the campus of what today is called Southwestern Adventist University. I drove up to meet her. She met me at the door, graciously invited me in. We sat down in her family room where she did her writing. And the 30 minutes that I had asked stretched into an hour and 30 minutes. I felt guilty for taking so much of her time. But she was so interested in Ellen White that she kept me going, talking about Ellen White. And I finally said to her, Mrs. Dean, how was it that you happened to find out about Mrs. White and got interested in researching her for your book? And she said, there was an Adventist lady named Helen Smith. She now sleeps in Jesus. Helen Smith was one of our first ladies in the public relations department of the General Conference, now called the communications department. I knew Helen personally. And she said, Helen Smith introduced me to Ellen White, and I was so interested and I was so curious about this remarkable, amazing lady that I did research on my own, and I wound up giving her a full chapter-length treatment in my book. You have all heard, I am sure, of Paul Harvey. What you may not know, and I didn't until today when I was doing more research down in the public library, is that Paul Harvey is 82 years of age this year. He doesn't sound 82 on his radio program. You know, somebody said to me one time, you sound a lot like Paul Harvey in your presentations. And I said, he copied me, but I didn't mind. Actually, in 1966, I met him personally. Paul Harvey was the speaker for the closing Saturday night of the Michigan camp meeting that year. And that afternoon, Morton Juberg, who was the public relations director of the Michigan conference, said to me, "Have you ever met Paul Harvey?" And I said, "No, I've been accused of talking like he does, but I've never met him." He said, "Would you like to?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Well, I'm going out to meet him at the Grand Ledge Airport." Airport was a kind of an overdrawn title for a little grassy airstrip at Grand Ledge. And he says, "I'm going out to meet him to bring him in for the evening meeting. Would you like to come along?" I said, "I'd be delighted. I'd like to see this man who talks like I do." So I went out, and it was about 5 o'clock, getting late in the afternoon. And pretty soon, in the distance, in the west, coming across Lake Michigan, was this two-engined beach craft, which was his private plane. I'm sure he has a Learjet by now. This was back in 66, you know, 34 years ago. He had his own private plane, his own private pilot. Pretty soon, the plane landed and pulled up to where we were standing, and the door opened, and Paul Harvey jumped down, and his pilot came out. And Morton said to the pilot, "We have a little supper, a little reception, a little meal for Mr. Harvey before he speaks, because he's obviously missed supper flying across from Chicago. Would you like to come in, and we'd be happy to feed you also?" And the man said, "No, I can't." "Why not?" He said, "Every time Mr. Harvey's plane is on the ground, I stay on guard duty. He gets a lot of crank mail. And you know, people who are prominent in public life get lots of crank mail. People that are psychotic, people that are half crazy, some of them even more than half crazy. And he said he gets a lot of death threats. And he said if some crazy person knew that his airplane was here on the ground and no one was around it, they might come and put sugar in the fuel tank or salt or something like that. And he said, my life is on the line when we're up in the air as well as Mr. Harvey's. He said, when this plane is on the ground at any other airport other than Chicago, where we have guards, security guards all the time, 24 hours a day, he said, I stand duty. And when we took Mr. Harvey back after his evening meeting, which was splendid, when we took him back, the pilot was still standing guard duty. And then Mr. Harvey got in the plane, they took off and winged their way back to Chicago. Well, Paul Harvey used to fetch an astronomical sum for his public lectures. 30-some years ago, it was in the tens of thousands of dollars. You might be interested to know what he fetches for a personal one-minute advertisement on his daily radio program on the ABC radio network. I just learned this a couple of weeks ago. For a one-minute commercial in Mr. Harvey's own voice, advertising, he gets $36,538.44 for 1 minute. You know, you could live for a whole year on what he gets for 1 minute. Well, I just mentioned this to kind of introduce the kind of person who has spoken so appreciatively over the years. I've got in my notes here, I couldn't begin to read you everything I've got. I've got statements that he has written over the years in his radio script, in his syndicated newspaper column, speaking about Miss Ellen White. This is the most recent one. This was September 27, 3 years ago. Exactly 3 years ago today. This is what he said in his syndicated newspaper column and his radio broadcast on ABC. "Women have been honored on American postage stamps for more than 100 years, starting with one woman who was not an American, Queen Isabella, and she was put on a stamp in 1893. Since Isabella, 86 women have been honored, ranging from Martha Washington to Marilyn Monroe, and also many women authors like Louisa May Alcott, Emily Dickinson, Willa Cather, and Rachel Carson. But I can name an American woman author who has never been thus honored. Though her writings have been translated into 148 languages, that number is now in the 150s. This was his statement of 3 years ago. She wrote more than Marx or Tolstoy, more than Agatha Christie, more than William Shakespeare. Only now is the world coming to appreciate her recommended prescription for optimum spiritual and physical health. Her name is Ellen White. Ellen White? You don't know her? Get to know her. And Mr. Harvey, way back in 1960, 40 years ago, he wrote a big column for his United Features Syndicate. It was republished in one of our medical health magazines. And this is what he had to say 40 years ago. He's still talking. 40 years later, he's still talking about Ellen White. This is what he had to say 40 years ago. Once upon a time, 100 years ago, there lived a young lady named Ellen White. She was frail as a child, completed only grammar school. Well, he missed it there. She only completed the third or fourth grade. And she had no technical training, yet she lived to write scores of articles and many books on the subject of healthful living. Remember, this was in the days when doctors were still bloodletting and performing surgery with unwashed hands. This was an era of medical ignorance bordering on barbarism. Yet, Ellen White wrote with such profound understanding on the subject of nutrition that all but two of the many principles she espoused have been scientifically established. And in the 40 years since he wrote these words first, those other two have been scientifically established as well. Professor of Nutrition, Clive McKay. We talked about him last Sabbath afternoon. We'll talk about him a little bit more in just a moment. Cornell University said how much better health the average American might enjoy if he had but followed the teachings of Mrs. White. Perhaps we should reread what she has taught. The oil as eaten in the olive is far preferable to animal oil or fat. Today we know about cholesterol. She knew fine flour, white bread, is lacking in nutritive elements to be found in bread that is made from whole wheat. And today we re-enrich our bread. She wrote, do not eat largely of salt back at the turn of the century. Now we know that we should keep the sodium intake low because of hypertension, high blood pressure, among other things. She wrote whole articles on the importance of not overeating, of not becoming overweight, of eating at each meal just two or three kinds of simple food, and don't eat more than is required to satisfy hunger. We have come to accept the wisdom of such advice so completely that it is difficult for us today to realize how revolutionary her theories were almost a century ago. Parenthesis, Seventh-day Adventists consider her knowledge divinely inspired. A long time before we learned about TV snacks, Mrs. White wrote, after irregular eating, when children come to the table, they do not relish wholesome food. Their appetites crave that which is hurtful to them. And she urged pure air, sunlight, abstemiousness, rest, exercise as natural remedies for illness. She wrote, tobacco is a slow, insidious, but most malignant poison. It is all the more dangerous because its effects are slow and at first hardly perceptible. Divinely inspired or not, Ellen White was indeed ahead of her time. Are there additional recommendations which this remarkable woman urged upon us which we have so far ignored? Two of her teachings haunt, this was written in 1960, two of her teachings haunt the more progressive nutritionists today, because if she is right about these things also, most of us are wrong and have yet to catch up to her advanced knowledge on nutrition. For example, Mrs. White wrote, "All wheat flour is not best for a continuous diet. Rather, a mixture of wheat, oatmeal, and rye would be more nutritious." And again, Mrs. White was essentially a vegetarian. She wrote, "The life that was in the grains and vegetables passes into the eater. We receive it by eating the flesh of the animal. How much better to get it direct?" And then he concludes his little article, "Do you suppose that we'll discover she was right about these things too?" That was written 40 years ago, 1960. Those things have been proven by scientific investigation and inquiry in the 40 years that have elapsed since Paul Harvey first put his pen to write these particular words. I think we mentioned Dr. Clive McKay last Sabbath afternoon, and I will not labor that point with you this evening, simply to remind you that he was the leading international authority in nutrition from the 1940s through the 1960s, period of about 30 years. Dr. McKay earned his Ph.D. at the University of California in Berkeley in 1925. He then spent the next 2 years working in a postdoctoral study in biochemistry at Yale as a National Research Council fellow, after which he joined the faculty of Cornell University and taught there for the next 35 years. He never taught in another school. He went to Cornell in 27, and he stayed there until he retired in 1962. As we mentioned, I think, last Sabbath afternoon, Dr. McKay's field of special interest and expertise was the history of nutrition. Give him a date in secular time, and he could do two things, almost like a computer. He could tell you who was talking in the field of nutrition, and secondly, what they were saying. And he refused to date the advent of modern scientific nutrition earlier than 1900, because most of what was being taught in the 19th century in the field of nutrition, most of it was arrant nonsense. And so when Dr. McKay found out about Ellen White through Helen Chen, who later married a gentleman named Chung, and now she is Helen Chen Chung, living in Oxnard or Camarillo, California, Southern California. Dr. McKay began to check out Mrs. White, and he was very much interested in what Mrs. White had to say, and as a result, Dr. Philip Chen, who was the father of this young lady, got in touch with Dr. McKay, visited him at his home in Ithaca, New York, off the campus of Cornell University, and finally, he invited Dr. McKay to write an article for the Adventist Review in which this scientist of great renown and repute, internationally acclaimed. It would take me 15 minutes to fully exploit his academic pedigree with you, and I shall not bore you with that this evening. I have it on paper. It is an impressive array of accomplishments. Anyway, Dr. McKay agreed, and so he wrote this article in which he said, and it appeared in the Adventist Review and Herald of February 26, 1959, he said, "To sum it up," this was his conclusion, "to sum up the discussion, every modern specialist in nutrition whose life is dedicated to human welfare must be impressed in at least four respects by the writings and the leadership of Ellen G. White. First, her basic concepts about the relation between diet and health have been verified to an unusual degree by the scientific advances of the past few decades. Someone may attempt to explain this remarkable fact by saying, Mrs. White simply borrowed her ideas from others. You know, I mentioned to you last Sabbath that when Francis Nicol came to McKay's home and said, "I'm Francis Nickel. I've come to talk to you about Ellen White." The good professor invited him in, sat him down, and the very first question, where did she get her material? And Nickel, in his book, Why I Believe in Mrs. E.G. White, which came out in 1962 and unfortunately is out of print now, in an aside to the reader, Nickel says, "This man was a Unitarian. I knew that he wouldn't understand the Christian concepts, categories of revelation and inspiration, but I had to say something. So I said to him, well, she merely copied her contemporaries." And right back at him, McKay said, "I can't accept that. That creates a bigger problem than it resolves." Now it's Nickel's turn to be surprised, and he said, "Why does it do that?" He says, "Because if she only copied her contemporaries, how did she know what to copy and what not to copy? She came out smelling like a rose every time. And most of what was written about health and diet and nutrition in the 19th century was arrant nonsense." We had a president of the Northern California Conference whose name was Elder Becker. He had a hobby. He collected 19th century health reformer books that were written by the health reformers. He had one book that was about that thick, pardon me, about 720 or 30 pages, by a well-known health reform writer in the 19th century. And in that book of perhaps 720 pages, there is at most about a page and a half, maybe only a page and a quarter, that sounds like what Ellen White wrote. If she copied, how did she know which two pages in this book of perhaps 720 pages, which two pages to copy and leave the rest of it out? She came out smelling like a rose every time. And McKay picked up on that when he wrote a little later for the Review and Herald. Some may attempt to explain this remarkable fact by saying Mrs. White simply borrowed her ideas from others. But, and this is the point he made personally to Elder Nickel, how would she know which ideas to borrow and which to reject out of the bewildering array of theories and health teachings current in the 19th century? She would have had to be a most amazing person with knowledge beyond her times in order to do this repeatedly successfully. And of course, as you know, she didn't finish the third or fourth grade of elementary school. Okay, that was his first point, why she was significant. Second place, everyone who attempts to teach nutrition can hardly conceive of a leadership such as that of Mrs. White that was able to induce a substantial number of people to improve their diets. Dr. McKay realized, as anyone advocating health reform today realizes, that it is extremely difficult to get people to change their dietary habits. People are strongly resistant in doing that, and she succeeded in changing the dietary habits of a remarkably large number of people on all of the six continents of the world. In the third place, Dr. McKay goes on, one can only speculate about the large number of sufferers during the past century who could have had improved health if they had accepted the teachings of Mrs. White. And fourth and lastly, one can wonder how to make her teachings more widely known in order to benefit the overcrowded earth that seems inevitable tomorrow unless the present rate of increase of the world's population is decreased. And this is how he concluded his article. In spite of the fact that the works of Mrs. White were written long before the advent of modern scientific nutrition, in spite of that, no better overall guide is available today. And when Helen Chen Chung was sharing with me her experience in introducing this world internationally famous nutritionist to the writings of Ellen White, she also shared with me, and this is in my little book, A Gift of Light. This is the first time that that letter had ever been published. She shared with me a letter that had been written December 18, 1958, just about the time of his retirement at Cornell. And he wrote her from Ithaca, "Dear Helen, you added to my interest in the Adventist program, and your father helped me by lending me books about Ellen White. Cornell libraries are very poor in this respect. If I were to start life all over again, I would like to be a Seventh-day Adventist. I believe that their philosophy has the best solution of the problems of living amidst the strains of the American culture. I have only made a slight beginning of discovering the wisdom of Mrs. White, and you were the one who introduced me. In the late 1950s, in fact, I think it was the year 1959, a Seventh-day Adventist graduate student was attending Columbia University Teachers College in New York City, taking a course from one of the very well-known professors, Dr. Florence Stratemeyer. Dr. Stratemeyer was well-versed in pedagogy, in the theory and practice of teaching, and one day this Adventist graduate student wanted to do a little personal witnessing. And so after class was over, she went up to Dr. Stratemeyer, this is 1959, handed her a copy of the book Education, which was published 56 years earlier in 1903, and said, Dr. Stratemeyer, I've discovered a very interesting book on education that was published a little over a half century ago, and I thought maybe you might like to look it over. And she said, indeed I would. And she remarked to the student, as she had mentioned in class previously, that most of the ideas about teaching and pedagogy and education that were being offered and advanced at the turn of the century were outmoded, outdated today, and most of those books were residing in the bowels of a library somewhere with dust covering them up to an inch thick. They were not being used today. Dr. Stratemeyer was interested to know that in 1959, as in the year 2000, this year, that book, Education, is a basic textbook in a course in Principles of Christian Education in every Seventh-day Adventist institution of higher learning, and we've got 90 of them around the circle of the earth on all six continents and some islands in the sea. Ellen White's book on education is still being used as a college textbook around the world in at least 90 Adventist institutions. Dr. Stratemeyer took the book home, came back to class the next day, and before she began her lecture for the day, she held up the book and remarked to the students that she expected to have a few yucks, laughter in reading something written 56 years ago, because, I mean, education theory has been leapfrogging itself exponentially all down the century. And she confessed to the class that this book that she was holding in her hand, published in the year 1903, was not only up to date, it was ahead of date, because some of the ideas that were developed in that book were only just then in 1959 beginning to be researched and discussed and studied around the academic circles. Again, Frances Nichol invited her to write a little testimonial for the Review and Herald, which she did. It was published in the Review August 6, 1959. And this is what she said. Recently, the book Education by Ellen White has been brought to my attention. Written at the turn of the century, this volume was more than 50 years ahead of its times. And I was surprised to learn that it was written by a woman with but 3 years of schooling. The breadth and depth of its philosophy amazed me. Its concept of balanced education, harmonious development, and that was one of her favorite phrases to describe Christian education, the harmonious development of the head, the heart, and the hand. Its concepts of balanced education, harmonious development, and of thinking and acting on principle are today advanced educational concepts. The object of restoring in man the image of God, the teaching of parental responsibility, and the emphasis on self-control in the child are ideals the world desperately needs today. Mrs. White did, of course, not necessarily use current terms. In fact, she did not use the word curriculum at all in her writings. But the book Education in Certain Parts treats of important curriculum principles. She was concerned with the whole learner, the harmonious development of mental, physical, and spiritual powers. Today, many are stressing the development of the intellect, but feelings and emotional developments are equally important. In our changing society, the ability to act on thought and in terms of principle is central. It is this harmonious development that is so greatly needed, yet so generally neglected in educational circles today. I am not surprised that members of the Seventh-day Adventist Church hold the writings of Mrs. White in great respect and make them central in developing the educational program in their schools. Well, there's another testimonial, in fact, two more that I want to share with you from non-American educators, which I think you will find as interesting as I did when I first discovered them. Back in 1953, a very well-known Japanese educator came to the United States in order to further his education. He is not a Christian. He's probably a Buddhist. And 6 years earlier, from when this was first reported, that would have been 1953, Professor, I'm not going to try to pronounce this Japanese name, Sunikichi Mizuno, I didn't come close, of Japan's Tamagawa University. He was formerly the head of the Tokyo Museum of Science and director of social education for the Japanese Ministry of Education. He is a foremost educational practitioner in Japan. Dr. Mizuno recommended to the Japanese educators of Japan Ellen White's book, Education. He said it would be good for parents, teachers, and students. He called it, and I quote, most profitable reading in our understanding of the new education. And then these were the words which he wrote in his recommendation. The book Education, written with the inspired pen of Ellen White, he's not even a Christian, he calls her an inspired writer, has for some 50 years been a well-known book, which has rendered the greatest possible service and joy to students, teachers, and parents the world over. When I was studying at the University of Illinois, it was my privilege to read the book in its original language, which of course is English. I was profoundly moved by the book at that time. And as I mentioned, Professor Mizuno is not a Christian and professes no particular religion, though probably is strongly influenced by Buddhism. And it has been my desire ever since to recommend this book to the educators throughout Japan. It is my sincere joy to hear that the book has finally been translated into the Japanese language. Then there was another man from Serbia. This happened between World War I and World War II. And I'm gonna really butcher his name too. It's one of those Serbian names, Raja R. Radisavljević. He was the Minister of Education. In this country, he would be called the Secretary of Education for the Serbian government after the First World War. He came to Teachers College, Columbia University in New York City, probably to get his doctoral degree. He came to find the newest and the best in educational policy and program for his newborn state of Serbia. When he went back to the Balkans in southern Europe, Dr. Radosavljević authored, and I use the word authored in quotes, he authored a book on religious and moral education. He wrote it in his native Serbian language, and it was published by a state university press in what would later become known as Yugoslavia. It was acclaimed by that institution, that university, as the best book on religious education in the Serbian language. Now, he wrote this book. When Adventist church leaders in Serbia read the work, they recognized it immediately. It was simply a translation of Ellen White's book, Education, into the Serbian language, and the only thing the doctor did was to write an introductory chapter for this book in the Serbian language. 80% of the new book came directly from Mrs. White's pen. Was it plagiarism? Well, who knows the good man's motivation. But if Charles Caleb Colton is correct in his dictum, imitation is the sincerest form of flattery, then Adventists should indeed feel flattered. There was another lady. Her name was Irmgard Simon. She was a German. She attended a German university, the University of Münster in Westphalen, Germany. She did her doctoral dissertation in the field of sociology, and she wrote on Ellen White. This has now been translated into English by an Adventist scholar, and I just want to share a few lines with you concerning this woman, not a Seventh-day Adventist, no axe to grind in promoting Ellen White. I just want to read a few lines of what she wrote in her book about Ellen G. White and her appreciation for this most remarkable American woman. As to the question of how it was possible that a woman who had never received a real education and also suffered from poor health, how she could fill such an important and far-reaching office in spite of these handicaps, well, many answers have been given. The most important reason was to be found in her powerful faith. And that was exactly what Edith Dean focused upon in her chapter on Mrs. White in Great Women of the Christian Faith. The most important reason was to be found in her powerful faith, in her strong religious equipment, and in her visionary capacity, things that rendered her absolutely certain of being one especially called. Apart from that, she was an exceptionally talented woman, rich in ideas and imagination, hungry for knowledge, always progressive and willing to improve herself, an exceedingly good public speaker and interpreter of the highest degree, and talented with an unusual capacity for organization. The feeling of being one especially chosen gave her energy, persistency, and patience. She was filled with lofty moral ideas, which she met in her own personal life and which she also expected her fellow beings to live up to. In addition to this, she knew human beings as few have done. She looked upon people in the modern way, in the wholeness of their beings with body, mind, and spirit as factors that had to be included in any consideration. She was without fear of men, courageous and consistent. She struggled within the movement to solve the many problems. She solved problems which the churches did not expect to see solved in many decades. In spite of her strong, yes, ecstatic union with God, she rarely lost the ground of reality. On the contrary, she tackled many of the practical questions in life. Ellen G. White lived for only one purpose, to benefit and expand the denomination she served in order that her church members might be well prepared and by a God-pleasing life belong to the number of what they called the remnant church. Her knowledge of the various subjects she would practice with all emphasis, yet not in an overzealous or fanatical way, for she rebuked all kinds of fanaticism, but in such a way as to fit prevailing circumstances. E.G. White was a wise and commanding woman, and she had a strong soul. She thought of and lived for the movement which she formed. She disdained, quote, the world, and worked untiringly for the purpose of breaking its ties and winning people for Christ. It is easy to understand that a person involved in such a work and its being its central figure would receive severe criticism, especially being a woman. Then on page 69, she discusses the question of whether or not Mrs. White was one of the renowned mystics of the church. And she was of the opinion that there is no adequate scientific explanation for her visions and her experience. And then she mentions one of the most astonishing things. The highly respected and very well-known European theologian of the Roman Catholic Church, Dr. Karl Rahner, somehow learned about Mrs. White, and he said about Mrs. White, this is Karl Rahner, leading Catholic theologian in Europe, "Ellen White might very well have been canonized if she had been a Roman Catholic." They won't canonize her because she wasn't. Then Dr. Irmgard Simon goes on, "Undoubtedly, it was the established fact of her mystic vision of God which worked as a powerful radiance on her fellow believers, enabling her to be their leader without holding an official office in the church." And Ellen White never once in her lifetime held an official office in the Seventh-day Adventist Church. The nearest she came was she was willing to be a member of the board of trustees of our little school at Madison, Tennessee, simply to show her appreciation for and her respect for and her support for some organizations which were working in harmony with the church but were apart from the official church itself. She functioned as a messenger between God and the churches. Through her, the members had a part in the divine being. This explains the strong position Ellen White has won among Adventists. In spite of her high position, Ellen White never fell for the temptations other founders of various movements have done, where they claim to be elevated themselves above the weaknesses of human flesh, but she was a servant and did not claim the honor that belongs to God. And then this final sentence, "The Seventh-day Adventists still live on in the spirit of Ellen White. And only as far as this heritage lives on do the Adventists have a future." I thought that was very perceptive. When she died, Ellen White's life became the subject of a number of obituaries in the press, some of them on the editorial pages. I'm going to read you, and because of the shortness of time, only the last paragraph of two editorials that were written about Ellen White by secular newspaper editors who had no axes to grind. I'm going to read you how they summed up, how they evaluated the life and the ministry of Ellen White. The Toledo Blade came out on July 19, 4 days after she died. She died on July 16, no, 3 days. She died on July 16, 1915. And this was the last paragraph of an editorial which was entitled "A Modern Prophetess." And this was the last paragraph. I won't take time to read it all. Time is slipping away. "Mrs. White was a remarkable woman. Had she lived in an earlier period of the career of Christianity and escaped the bigots and the fire, she would most surely have been canonized, for she was of the flesh of which saints are made." And then the next month in the New York Independent, a newspaper which is no longer published today but was a daily newspaper at that time, this is how the New York Independent editor summed up the life of this remarkable woman. "Did she really receive divine visions? And was she really chosen by the Holy Spirit to be endued with the charism of prophecy? Or was she the victim of an excited imagination, as some allege? Why should we answer? One's doctrine of the Bible may affect the conclusion he was so true. At any rate, she was absolutely honest in her belief, in her revelations. Her life was worthy of them. She showed no spiritual pride, and she sought no filthy lucre. She lived the life and did the work worthy of a prophetess, the most admirable of the American succession." Why do I believe Ellen White was a true prophet of the Lord? I've already given you three much stronger reasons than the reason I give you tonight. She fulfilled Bible prophecy. She met admirably the four Bible tests of a prophet. And there was undeniably something supernatural in her experience. Those are much more powerful reasons than the reason that I give you tonight, because many prominent non-Seventh-day Adventists have spoken with such discernment, with such insight, and in such an interesting way concerning her life and her ministry to this people. I believe she was a true prophet because, not only for the three reasons I've already advanced, which are much more important than the reason for tonight, but the fact that these non-Adventists, and folks, I've only given you a tithe of the material that I've got. I've got at home, I've got about 30 pages of material, single space typewritten, about 30 pages of things that I just don't have time to share with you tonight. This is just a sampling, a tithe of the material that I have collected just myself over the years as I've been interested in non-Adventist interest in and respect for and recognition of the life and the ministry of Ellen White. No, friends, we have not followed cunningly devised fables. We have a more sure word of prophecy. Whereunto ye do well, that ye take heed as unto a light that shines in a dark place until the day dawn and the day star arise in your heart. Will you stand with me for a benediction prayer? Father in heaven, it has been interesting tonight to see how those who have no connection with the church, who have no affiliation with the church, who have not joined the church, but who have objectively examined the life and the ministry and the work of your special servant, it is interesting to see how they have written concerning her. She told us herself to judge from the preponderant weight of the evidence. And Lord, the preponderant weight of the evidence falls very heavily in her corner in support of what the church has claimed through the years. Thank you for bringing us here tonight. Send us home safely. Give us a good night of rest. May we rise refreshed tomorrow, and then bring us back tomorrow evening as we continue our seminar. And we thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.
This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette or reel-to-reel in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright, American Christian Ministries. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.AmericanChristianMinistries.org. There you would discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.